Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very, it's not the first day, it's the second day. Isn't this weird to have a holiday today? At any rate, it's all things political for the first time in 2017, and now officially it is Wisconsin Public Radio's 100th anniversary year. Yes, isn't that amazing? 100 years we've been on the air. We haven't been on the air that long, but the station has been on the air that long. Well, we have a lot to talk about for all things political as we start a new year, and we're happy to have David Winston with us this hour. David is president of the Winston Group. It's a D.C. strategic planning and survey research firm. He has served as a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership. He is the former director of planning for the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. He advises center-right political parties throughout Europe. He was a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is an election analyst for CBS News and frequently on cable news and also on network television. And they've done this very interesting, thorough, and extremely well done, the Winston Group, 2016 post-election analysis. It is titled Rock the Boat, an analysis of the 2016 presidential election. We'll talk about their findings. And we have a lot of other things to discuss as well. The Republican Congress is mapping plans for a very conservative agenda. We'll talk about that agenda, what legislation is important to the Republican Congress and to the Republican president. We'll look at cabinet picks, looming Supreme Court nomination. We'll, of course, be talking about the Russian hacking allegations and cybersecurity plans, what President-elect Donald Trump has said about the Russians. And he evidently is going to have some intelligence briefing probably tomorrow or Wednesday. We'll be looking at the future of the Affordable Care Act, and that's just a few things on the list. So feel free to join in with whatever you would like to discuss this hour of All Things Political. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. And David, Happy New Year. Thanks for being with us.
Happy New Year, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here on this very first All Things Political. An honor to have you with us. Let's start with your analysis. I thought that 2016 post-election analysis was very thorough and extremely well done. It's just good. You spent a lot of time on that.
Part of it, you know, one of the things, and this is true for both parties, one of the things that you see when parties make errors after they've won or lost an election because they didn't really sit down and think through what just happened, and actually, interestingly enough, the party who wins tends to make more errors than the party that loses, because the party that loses is trying to figure out what they did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The party that wins just assumes they did everything right. And so one of the things over the years that I've really focused on is really trying to understand what happened from a dispassionate, disengaged look in terms of just really looking at what the numbers are trying to say. I'll just give you a good example in terms of a dynamic. In 2010, there was a perception that the reason the election was won for Republicans was because of health care, and it really wasn't about health care. It was about the economy and jobs. And what had happened was the president just was on the wrong topic, and the public wasn't agreeing or disagreeing with the Health Care Act, and that obviously has implications for the moment, too, as well. But it was, since he was on the wrong topic, and all these Republicans were on the right topic, and understanding that it more clearly would have, in fact, allowed everybody to really engage in the next couple of years more effectively in terms of trying to get things done. So elections, are understanding really what happened is important. And unfortunately, I've got a venue through CBS where I get a chance to look at a lot of data. And so mm-hmm. it helps me in terms of being able to sort of sift through it.
One of the major messages, of course, of the election, people want to see change in their own lives, you write, and they're willing to rock the boat and will certainly be willing to do so again if they don't see results. What results are they looking for?
They're looking to just see things move forward in some way. They want to watch. They want to see Washington rather than trying to figure out how to win partisan fights against each other. And this is true for both parties. And so they're not fighting with one over the other here in this particular case. They just want to see some things move forward. Sure, they would like things perfect, but their attitude is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. And I think what you saw in a lot of cases is people looking at the situation, saying, how come all these decisions are being made and I'm not having a say in this? And then there was this whole sense that the system was sort of rigged, the economic system was rigged against them. And you heard that from both sides, in terms of both liberals and conservatives, Sanders voters, Trump voters, really having this sense of their voice not being heard, that somehow things were being rigged against them. And so they want to see some things move forward. They want to see the economy reach everybody in terms of being able to make lives better. On top of that, they have a very short patience here for this. They want to see it happen quickly, and they were willing to take a political risk. I mean, when you sat in focus, because people knew that there was a risk here involved in terms of Trump being president, but their attitude was, we just need to shake things up or else nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the policy that he outlined during the campaign, making the economy reach everyone, what does he need to do? Is it some kind of a stimulus package? Does he really need to make sure that jobs are not moved overseas? What do you see in his rhetoric and in his true beliefs that will make the economy work for everyone?
Well, let's start with basically everything you just said, all the above, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I think in this particular case, people want to see some real results, right? You know, they've seen a situation where some of the economic numbers, you know, look like they were getting better, but they weren't feeling it. And so I think it's a little more complex than just simply looking at a singular number. The initial one that you've seen the Trump team focus on has been sort of getting GDP to 4%, this idea that if you generate that level of economic growth, a lot of things will happen. But, there are going to have to be other elements, too. So how do we keep manufacturing jobs in the country? How will we potentially attract them back? How do we, in fact, get companies to begin to bring dollars back and reinvest here? I mean, there are a variety of different things that they're going to be looking at. But the ultimate challenge here is this is not just simply, you know, can we, you know, if we get the economic growth to 4%, but wages aren't going up, then that's not a satisfactory conclusion either. So there are a lot of elements in play here. And it's not a simple task by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to be a little bit like it works when people sort of see that they and their friends and people in their community, their lives are actually getting better, that they actually have the economic opportunities that don't seem to exist for many at this point.
Mm-hmm. And David, what's he going to do about taxes?
I'm assuming that because they've just literally started here, the taxes as a tool by which to generate that sort of economic activity and that sort of economic growth that will impact. So at this point, there are a whole slew of ideas on the table. And so I think in terms of everybody who's listening, you're going to hear literally everything. That doesn't mean that everything is going to happen. I think it's going to be just a lot of discussion to try to work through what they think will best make things sort of take off. Initially, what you're hearing is obviously some middle class tax cuts, tax cuts to business, because at least at this point there's a sense that it's giving businesses from other countries some advantage in terms of less cost overseas to produce a product than it is here. So I think some things dealing with trade. The big one is going to be the amount of money that corporations have overseas, somehow trying to get those dollars back and sort of working here in the country. So I think those are probably sort of outlines of the general theme. How the specifics look, that's a little ways off. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You describe in this analysis that you've done this country as being a center-right country, and the party is a center-right party. The Republicans are a center-right party. The Donald Trump is a center-right party. Does he differ in philosophical description from what most Republicans would consider themselves? And what do we mean by center-right?
Well, where I get the conclusion of center-right is from the exit polls. And in this last election, what you had, and this is I use the congressional level, that just so people out there, your audience, really, they're on election night, the exit polls interview about 25,000 people. And they take a look at both the presidential race and the congressional race. I use the congressional data, which is slightly different from the presidential data because it lets me compare obvious as well. So in this particular election, 38% were moderate, 35% were conservative, and 26% were liberal. And where I get center right is that the dominant group is there. The largest group is still moderates, but they're just simply more conservatives than liberals. So that sort of edges you center right. Having said that, one of the things that's been interesting in terms of trends is you've seen moderates back in 2000. Moderates made up half the electorate, 50%, and they've now dropped down to 38%. Conservatives are about the same. They've been in the mid 30s. Actually, liberals is where you've seen a slight increase. Again, going back to 2000, it's 20%. And this election is 26%, with a slight increase for conservatives as well, but liberals more so. So you've seen the country become a little bit more ideologically polarized, but nonetheless, moderates are still the largest group of the three.
Mm-hmm. I know you've done advising, and perhaps still are, of center-right parties all over Europe. E.J. Dionne he's quite a critic of Donald Trump, and there are a lot of people who are worried about Donald Trump, as you well know. Mm-hmm. He wrote in a piece yesterday about the dangers that democracy confronts. He cites the rise of far-right parties in Europe, citing Turkey, Hungary, Poland, the ebbing of the center-left and center-right parties that were part of the post-war democratic consensus. And he quotes a Financial Times columnist in his description of Donald Trump as a right-wing demagogue in charge of the world's most influential repository of democratic values. Are there reasons to be worried about Donald Trump? Is that in some ways an apt description? And how, as somebody who's advised so many parties that aren't nearly as far to the right as what I just cited, how do you explain that?
Well, I think part of I know EJ well, and for obvious reasons, he has a particular, obviously different view than I do, although he's tough to beat in arguments, I will tell you. but having said that, I think at this point, people are jumping to conclusions based on perception and not necessarily, we haven't seen real discussion in terms of where things are going. So I think there's at least at this point a way of reaction. Now, having said that, part of this was brought on by Trump in terms of the way he was handling other candidates. There were comments that he made. There was the sort of tenor of the campaign at moments that clearly fostered concern that individuals have at this point and continue to have. Having said that, at least at this point, you've heard some level of toning down, although you're beginning to watch perhaps a more difficult transition than perhaps it initially started out. Transition, I mean, watching one president basically transition the power to the next one. So that's sort of made things more complicated. But I would urge people to be vigilant in terms of watching for things. But I think at this point that there's been an overreaction, and part of it was because it was such a surprise for a lot of people that they had not really thought through that there was a possibility here that he was going to become president, and so it came as a very jarring moment. And you've watched people try to explain away things in such a way to accommodate their particular perception of what they think's at fault, as opposed to, that's what Rock the Boat was about, was basically what I was looking at was an electorate that was frustrated, that was willing to take political chances, mm-hmm. understanding that they were taking a political chance. But their sense of the way things were working at this point, things were just broken, and a reinforcing number that stretches beyond just that group, but to the country as a whole. When you take a look at people's attitude about the direction of the country basically since the financial meltdown in 2008, by at least a 2-to-1 margin, people have thought the country's been heading in the wrong direction. So is the country willing to take a risk? Absolutely. Now the challenge is, now that that step has been taken, how in fact do you make that work? And to your point to the folks who are concerned, the expectation to have a vocal opposition is absolutely essential in any democracy.
When you looked in your analysis of the issues that were important to Republicans in the race, the issues that were important to Democrats, did you come up with two different lists, or were there a lot of crossovers?
Well, if there's a thing that I found frustrating about this election, there are three groups actually. So if you look at the independents. Right. The independents were predominantly focused on the issues, jobs and the economy, what was going on, you know, the potential with health care, what was happening in terms of foreign affairs. Interestingly enough, you saw that the Supreme Court nominations mattered, but it was basically policy oriented. What you saw for the respective parties was that for Democrats, the attacks on Trump were really important, and for Republicans, the attacks on Hillary Clinton were really important. So for the respective bases, attacking the other person's candidate, the other party's candidate, was something that was useful, but it was only useful for your political base, right? Truth be told, the independents, at least in terms of this, the independents, they wanted to hear what was going to happen policy-wise, and that's what they were focused on. So when everybody talks about, oh, it was Comey, or it was Trump's comments or relationship with Russia, those tended to drive the opposite party, i.e., if you're talking about Trump's relationship with Russia, that tended to drive the Democratic base. Independents were looking for how's the country going to change. And so you had two very different discourses going on at the same time. The media tended to focus on the political attacks more so than the issues, and so you also see independents being a little frustrated with the media. For it completely different than the two parties, in that they wanted to hear more about issues. And as a result, tended to appreciate things like the debates, because it was a chance for them to really hear what the candidates were actually saying.
I'm trying to think of another time in history, and perhaps one will come to your mind, but when you look at how people didn't like either one of these candidates and their unfavorable ratings so high for both Clinton and for Trump, so there are going to be a lot of people who aren't very happy about who was elected. What does that mean for us, and why did that happen?
Let's start off with neither party has ever nominated somebody where a majority of the country had an unfavorable view of them. And in this case, we had both parties do it, right? So you start off with that as a really interesting dynamic. Then you have the situation. And here was the point that I think people missed in terms of trying to make a call in terms of where the election was going. Most of the polling, interestingly enough, was not that far off. Where the errors were occurring were what I call the aggregators, the people who were assigning a percentage probability to it, because they were missing one key element in that, and that element was this, that you had this group of people, it was about 20% of the country, who going into the last couple months here had an unfavorable view of both. And the question was, how were they going to make that decision? And that was a large number of the population, and that was a critical moment. What they ended up doing was breaking by about a 20-point margin for Trump. And what basically happened was, in the end, those people didn't like either one, and their way they made this decision was, who was going to potentially generate the most amount of change? Since she was sort of running, doing a third term, and he was clearly running on let's do everything completely different. That just in terms of those late voter or those late deciders who were unfavorable of both, they broke to him by a pretty significant margin. And if you take a look at looking at the exit polls, how he did in October and the last couple of days, she was basically up 5 or 6 points coming out of September, and then he ended up getting all those late deciders. And that's an example of understanding what a survey says. There's things that surveys say, and when you're looking at the data, and then there are additional questions they posed, and nobody was really looking at the additional questions they were posing, and that was the big one.
And, David, do you know how many of those late deciders broke for him because of Comey?
At least in terms of this, Comey was not a decision point, because by the time Comey came out again in October, a lot of this was already breaking toward him already. And so basically what it came down to is the two strategies by the two sides. Hillary Clinton's team thought that if they could marginally increase the negatives on Donald Trump, that somehow that would be the deciding factor. The Trump team just decided that we're going to change everything, and so they're going to be the agent to change. And when you're looking at a right track, wrong track, it was so bad. People are looking for something different, and that was basically their choice. I think Comey and everything dealing with the emails, and that was already baked in way before that. If you hadn't made up your mind at that point about that, and sort of going both directions, if you hadn't really made up your mind, was Comey going to change your mind that much now? People, again, because they already had the unfavorable view, they were just trying to figure out how do I make a decision between the two of them.
We will talk about Russia as we continue. Donald Trump did say on Saturday that, referring to the hacking situation, that he knows things that other people don't know. They can't be sure of the situation. And we'll find out what he was referring to either tomorrow or Wednesday, because he will be taking security briefings. But David talked about Russia being a concern and Donald Trump's relationship. What is Donald Trump's relationship with Russia? We will talk about that and that story that continues to be front and center as we approach the inauguration. Here is our phone number. We would love to hear from you. It's our first All Things Political for 2017. Big changes underway politically, a big transition, presidential transition, and we're going to be talking about what that means. And one-party control of the House and the Senate and the presidency in this country. Is there a conservative agenda? We'll ask David about that. What's the future of the Affordable Care Act? What about Supreme Court nominations? What about cabinet nominations? Are any of those likely to face pretty stiff, maybe it won't be stiff, but will any of those nominees be in trouble when it comes to Senate confirmations? Will there be significant opposition or not? What will the Democrats do? What kind of party will they be? They're kind of in shambles here. If they don't like something that's being done, what power do they have, if any? Here is our phone number. We'd love to hear from you. And also, it was a significant election, and David has been in charge of this very, very well done. We'll have it on our Facebook page if you would like to see the analysis that they did, Rock the Boat, the analysis of the 2016 election. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Scotty Myers is answering phones here today. Wish him a happy 2017. And he'll wish you the same. This is the Ideas Network. David Winston is here for All Things Political. David is president of the Winston Group, which is a D.C. strategic planning and survey research firm. He's been a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership, formerly director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He advises center-right parties throughout Europe and is an election analyst for CBS News, and the list goes on. A lengthy resume he has. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with TJ in Bayport, Minnesota. Hi, TJ.
What?
Hi, TJ. Go right ahead.
Oh, hello. How are you doing? So I'm just basically wanted to bring to light that I don't hear a lot of people talking about, which is the Project Veritas videos that were servicing during the elections.
Okay.
Are you familiar with them?
David?
No, I have to say no, I'm not.
Well, all you have to do is Google Project Veritas, and Veritas in Latin means truth. Mm-hmm. And basically, some activists infiltrated an organization that works for the DNC, and they have them. If you just Google Project Veritas or YouTube Project Veritas, all their videos comes up. There's like 6 or 7 videos that you can see for yourself. And they basically, the DNC, the company, the organization that works for the DNC basically admits to, rigging the elections and busting people in and whatnot. And this all surfaced during the elections, but see, the mainstream media doesn't cover it.
And that story was covered. I believe that it was sort of a day in the news, and then it sort of disappeared, David. I didn't hear much follow-up on that story. Did you?
No, I didn't. But again, the break-in with the DNC and the whole fake news dynamic that sort of began to emerge here, I think is going to be something that obviously everybody's going to have to take some time, take a step back and think through. You know, one of the challenges that has emerged from this environment that we're in now, in terms of being able to post whatever we want, whenever we want,
right.
What happens if something goes viral that in fact is not true? How do you manage that? It is obviously creating a complex element to what is political discourse. And there's obviously a fine line here between, well, you need to be able to identify what's not true, but at what point do you then start dealing with the fact that, okay, is that censorship? You know, there is the John Stuart Mill line of the best thing for poor free speech is more free speech, right? but obviously he did that before the age of the internet, and so what's being brought up here is a combination of two things: one, what do you do with fake news? But two, also, what do you do with the dynamic that, truth be told, anybody who's got a computer has potentially got something that's vulnerable to somebody who wants to hack it, and how do we manage that in this environment as well? So if there was an example of technology potentially or having played an interesting and potentially critical role in an election beyond what the campaigns themselves were specifically doing, this certainly is it, and brought up some very tough ethical, moral yes. questions in terms of how do we handle this.
Yes. Well, as long as we're talking about hacking, let's talk about hacking and Russian hacking. There have been people like John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who are pushing for a sharper response than what President Obama has given to the Russians. Others are downplaying this issue in the Republican Party. I'm not sure where Donald Trump stands on this at this point. I guess he's getting an intelligence briefing today or maybe tomorrow on what the intelligence agencies know about the hacking. A couple questions. What do you think of the response? What do you think of the Republican response? And what do you think is the relationship, if we know it, that the president-elect has with Russia?
Well, let's start off with, at least in terms of, if there's something serious, and I can guarantee you that John McCain, if there's something serious is there, he's going to pursue it. Again, that's just the nature of who he is, and that will happen. And I think to a large degree what you're hearing from the Trump transition is just trying to sort of work through, you know, they're trying to put together a government and trying to sort of manage this. And to some sense, there have been some folks who have said that, well, this was why he won, which is, I would argue, not correct. Again, this is about the economy, and I think that's people trying to come up with rationales as to why he won as opposed to the fact that he actually did. Whether they like the outcome or not, I mean, the number one issue was jobs in the economy. But having said that, I don't think it's clear. And I think one of the important, in terms of Trump's relationship with Russia, I think that's one of the important things that he needs to outline quickly so that people have an understanding. That's obviously, at least at this point, a major point of policy discussion, from people who are concerned about his presidency, and so he's got to be very clear. You know, one of the things about diplomacy is that surprises are not good things. You know, you want people to understand how you're going to behave and how you react, so when they're making their decisions about what their country's going to do, they can basically understand what the response is going to be from the United States and other countries. And so I think one of the challenges here for President-elect Trump is to, in fact, make sure that that continues in an effective way. Tillerson is someone who's run a large organization as the nominee for Secretary of State, and so certainly has that understanding as it operated in the international environment, given that he's ExxonMobil for quite a few years. Again, there were some concerns raised about his potential closeness in terms of having dealt with Russia, but to a large degree, any oil company is going to have had some level of relationship with Russia, given the amount of resources they have there. But to your point, this is going to be a very important and initial signal in terms of how he's going to handle his presidency.
Let's go to Kathleen in Minneapolis. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to David is really about what you were talking about earlier in terms of you said something like we don't really know what's going to happen in terms of like the Affordable Care Act or taxes or those sorts of things. But I am really concerned, given some of the political appointees that Mr. Trump is making, that we are getting signals about what's going to happen to things like education. I mean, his choice of DeVos for the education secretary is, I find, jarring. Or as Secretary of Commerce. These appointees that seem almost diametrically opposed to the positions that they're taking. I mean, obviously, I am a liberal and voted for Clinton, and I loved Hillary Clinton. I'm one of those people who just never understood anybody's unhappiness with her. So I'm really, frankly, fearful. And I'd love to hear, you know, what you say to people like me who are really concerned about some of the political appointees being made and what that means for really our day-to-day, you know, things that affect us, education, taxes, affordable housing, those sorts of things.
Thank you, Kathleen, for your call. David?
Well, let me first go to the variety of topics that you raised.
Mm-hmm.
Let me go to, and you've raised this as well, so let's address this in terms of health care. Here, there are two pieces to health care, and, you know, and for years it's been this concept of repeal and replace. Well, to some degree, because you had a sitting Democratic president who basically authored the Health Care Act, the chances of repeal were at best minimal, right? And so, but now all of a sudden, this is clearly on the table. And just so everybody understands why repeal can work, given the Senate not having 60 votes, there's a process known as budget reconciliation, which only requires a majority vote. That's originally how the Health Care Act got passed, and that's likely the process for repeal as well. So in this particular case, you only need a majority in the Senate as opposed to the normal 60% to avoid a filibuster, or not 60%, 60 members, rather. Having said that, one of the challenges that exists is, you know, this has now been in place for quite a few years, and so there are a lot of people who have health care coverage in a different way that just simply repeal. Is you've got to work through how do you handle the transition. Okay, you've identified point B, i.e. the repeal, but ultimately how do you go from A to B? And I think what you're going to watch in terms of Republicans in the House and the Senate is you've got to figure that out to some degree. No, not to some degree. You've got to figure that out before you begin this process, because you can't suddenly have 10 million people without health insurance. You can't suddenly completely tear apart how somebody is, in fact, getting their current health care. So it will not be an uncomplicated process. Having said that, a lot of the basic concepts that the President Obama put into place are not going to be there. But the challenge here to Republicans in Congress is, okay, what is that replace going to look like? What are the fundamental principles behind that? Having said that, and having dealt with Tom Price, who's now the current nominee for the Health and Human Services, I can tell you that having dealt with him, and on the Republican side, there's a group called the Doctors Caucus, which includes people like Phil Rowe, Tennessee, and Burgess, and obviously Tom Price, who's a doctor as well, who have been thinking through this and have understood for a while the absolute necessity for having a good replace, that it just can't simply be one without the other. So at one level, I guess what I would say to the person is, look, you know, there are obviously going to be policy changes, but they're not going to be done in a way that just sort of it's not like suddenly taking and ripping the Band-Aid off. It's going to be a process of, okay, if we're going to do this, what are we going to move to that will work better, and argue and lay out those arguments to the electorate and to the Congress to move things forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I use that as an example in terms of there are clear directions that people want to go here, but they're not going to just do it pell-mell. They're going to think through it and make sure, for obvious reasons, because if it doesn't work, and this is the rock the boat concept, they're going to face an electorate in 2 years. And if you remember, the Republican Party was dead after 2008 and then ended up coming back and winning the House in 2010. That should be a good lesson to every Republican, that you can have a really good win. And then 2 years later, if you haven't done what you said you were going to do, run into some serious difficulty.
So, David, does that mean, I can see a repeal happening pretty quickly, but replacing, when you think about all the years we've spent in this country talking about health care and trying to come up with some kind of plan and how difficult it is, it's hard to imagine that Republicans, even though they have full control here, will be able to come up with a plan that will replace Obamacare before the midterms, do you think?
Well, I think you saw sort of a first attempt at looking at the healthcare situation slightly differently that actually the president signed into law, and that was this whole concept of cures that was passed out of the House. This is actually an initiative by Fred Upton and Lamar Alexander in terms of focusing on cures for the future. 21st century cures was the name of the bill. And that was sort of a different approach in terms of how to begin to think through the healthcare problem. I mean, part of the challenge that I would argue that the president ran into in terms of his current plan was he basically had a finite amount of healthcare, and he was trying to put another 15 to 20 million people into that. He was trying to limit the use of some of that healthcare, I'm taxing what is known as Cadillac plans, but ultimately supply and demand works, and you've seen price go up because there's just not enough health care. So what 21st Century Cures is an example of is potentially thinking through, so how do you just have more, you know, expanding the universe of health care available to people? Now, having said that, that's obviously a complicated and longer dynamic, and so I think one of the things that you're likely to see as you work through repeal and replace is, and to your point, there may be a bill passed this year, but it may be, you know, a 3-year process of implementation, 5-year process. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's the policy people to work through. But I think you're likely to see something along those lines.
Kathleen mentioned her concern about education. DeVos does not seem to have much enthusiasm for public education in this country. Does it make a difference what her thoughts are in terms of how schools are run, in terms of the number of public schools in each state in the country? How can she influence policy?
Well, I'm going to kind of differ a little bit in terms of the analogy versus that. I think she sees that there are opportunities that exist with charter schools, and she's clearly been a charter school advocate for years, right? I mean, there's no question about that. I don't think that she's saying that public schools are therefore bad. I think what she's been trying to say here is there are some opportunities in terms of what charter schools can do, and charter schools have their own challenges as well, but not to just limit the option to just one way of approaching it is where she's at. Now, having said that, she's put a lot of her own personal resources into advocating that point of view, and obviously coming in as Secretary of Education, that's going to be a clearly a doctrine in terms of how she's going to look at the issue of education. But I wouldn't say, that it's a reasonable conclusion that in fact she doesn't support public education. I think what she's going to be coming in and saying so. How can we take this one element and try to overall improve the education system? I think there's some challenges with the most recent NAEP tests were not particularly inspiring in terms of seeing the progress that I think we would like to see as a country. And the same thing with the recently released international test, PISA, also not necessarily seeing the sort of growth that we would like to see if we're going to stay competitive at an intellectual level with the rest of the world. And so, going to her point, this is a critical moment, not the boss, but your caller. This is an important moment in terms of the U.S. education, and we do need to get this right. And if she's particularly concerned about something, I would that make sure that she has her voice heard as best she can.
David Winston is our guest, and you're listening to our first All Things Political for this brand new year. David is president of the Winston Group, a strategic planning and survey research firm. He's been a strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership and formerly the director of planning for Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. He's a CBS analyst, and they've just compiled, it's very, very well done, and if you want to look at a complete analysis of the 2016 election, we will have this this on our Facebook page. It's an in-depth 2016 post-election analysis. Rock the Boat is the title, filled with valuable information. If you want to know why we did what we did, you may want to give it your eyes and attention. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. David Winston is our guest. All things political is what you're listening to. Greg sends this message on Facebook. He is pretty angry. Oh, come on, he says. Let's face it. The Republicans are in the driver's seat. They control all branches of the government. They can do whatever they want. This has been in the planning stages for years. The guess from you, David, that Comey didn't influence the election is ridiculous. It's sounding more and more like the Republicans pretty much control Wisconsin Public Radio as well.
I bet you
Happy New Year
to that one. Yeah. Well, let me start off with one. Given the fact that President Obama and the Democrats literally had everything in 2008, would that person say that, well, they had free reign, they could do whatever they want, and we all know, right? And they didn't, right? I mean, the president was able to get health care through, but there were a lot of other initiatives that obviously didn't happen. And in that particular case, he did have a filibuster-proof Senate, at least for the first year. Having said that, to his point, however, clearly, it's better to have the House and the Senate, the White House, to try to get things done than having one of the and for your party to try to move things forward than not. But you're still, again, you're going to have the filibuster in the Senate outside of the budget reconciliation dynamics. And again, you've got some, it's not like you can count on, just as the president, President Obama couldn't with Democrats, even when he had 60, count on every single Democratic vote. You're not always going to be able to count on every single Republican vote either in terms of the Senate as well. And so it's still going to take some effort. Having said that, clearly, given this election, it's going to be a more conservative direction than had been pursued under President Obama, and that's clearly a difference. But again, this is an elective that is focused on outcomes, and they want to see something in terms of what the results are. Let me go back to one other interesting result from the from the exit polls. They asked what attribute was most important in terms of looking at a president. They had things like cares about people like me, has the right experience, has good judgment, can bring the needed change was the number one item, with basically 4 out of 10 Americans identifying that as the key attribute. And this is where the election really was decided. Donald Trump won those 82-14.
82-14. Significant.
What this ended up being about, and the challenges she ended up having, was that somehow she couldn't create that sense of I'm going to change things. Instead, it was sort of a continuation at a moment in time when the electorate really wanted to see a different direction, because again, the wrong track was just so bad. Can I go to one thing, just because for voters, for folks in the state, just to give you a sense of just that late breaking dynamic, and this is from the exit polls. If you actually took a look in terms of where things were going into the last week, according to the exit polls, into the last week, Hillary Clinton was actually leading by 2 points. It wasn't until that last week when a lot of those people were deciding who did dislike both, and they broke so heavily for Trump. And in fact, in this case, of those people who decided in the last week, they went for Trump by a 59-30 margin. So you can see how a 49-47 margin, a 2-point margin, can easily be overcome by that level. That's about 14% of the electorate, by the way. But that gives you a sense of people at the end just trying to work through, how do I decide between two people I don't like?
Mm-hmm. Including, which I found interesting, the union households, both in Wisconsin and in Michigan.
Yeah, and you saw those actually in Ohio as well, and basically the Rust Belt states. I hate that phrase. I'm originally from Ohio, so I'm not sure I'm fond of that. Anyway, but yeah, you saw the groups that he ended up putting together that were different, were union households, those making under 50,000, and those with less than a college degree. And you saw significant improvements. So to give you an example, he President Obama won union households by 33 points. Hillary Clinton only won them by 13. Right? And that gives you a sense of scale. It wasn't that Trump was necessarily carrying these groups. It's just that there were such large inroads. And that's where, for those four particular states, you saw a change happen. And I had to say, the one thing that was giving me pause as I was sort of watching this election, and everybody was saying, oh, it's definite for her. Donald Trump had been holding a pretty small but consistent lead in Ohio. And if there was going to be a path then in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, to have held a consistent lead in Ohio like that was at least, that would have to be the first step before the second step happened. And so when you take a look at the data amongst those groups, as we were describing, union households, those under 50 and those with less than a college education, that movement was consistent across all four of those states. And that's where the election was. Mm-hmm. It's basically won or lost.
Jack in Madison is next. Hi, Jack. Jack, are you there? Call us back, Jack. Rick in Algoma. Hi, Rick. What's about? Oh, it's Nick. I'm sorry, Nick. Hi. Where is everybody? Am I pressing the wrong button? No? Nick, are you there? All right, let's try Vince in Watertown. Hi, Vince.
Hi.
There we go. Hi, Vince.
Okay. It's great to get on.
Yeah, it's good to have you here.
I have one of my biggest concerns is that the Republicans always speak about their moral high ground and ethical values, and I think that Paul Ryan sold his soul to the Trump team, and they are not concerned about investigating what is really taking place and going on with Trump, especially when he said that maybe he knows more. Maybe he's referring to all of his connections with Russia in other countries and all the money that he owes to all these other people. And I don't know, I'd like to know, where's the Republican Party in standing up for their values and ethical and moral standards and really holding them accountable for who he is?
Well, knowing Paul Ryan, he will do that. I mean, if there's something that emerges that, in fact, needs to be investigated, I can guarantee that Paul Ryan, no matter what party it is, will make sure that oversight occurs and the way it should. Having said that, we're going to watch this as it sort of evolves. At this point, you're watching a situation where I think people are latching onto accusations and assuming that they're absolutely true. And I think I've watched this going both directions, whether it be Bill Clinton, whether it be Donald Trump, whether it be President Obama. You go through, when the opposition loses, there's always a sense of, so how do we discredit the victory? And I think the bigger challenges to political parties is, in this particular case, and one of the things that I think John Boehner did quite well after 2008 was, in fact, sit back and think through, okay, the problem isn't that Obama won. The problem is, what is it that we do to create an effective alternative that, in fact, people could engage with? And ultimately, that's what happened in 2010. I would suggest to you that that's the challenge to the Democratic Party, is that looking particularly those groups that we just mentioned, union households, those making under 50,000, who for a long time have been a clear part of, many of those individuals have been a clear part of the Democratic coalition and clearly left at this point. The challenge is thinking through, so what is it, what's the value proposition in this environment of the Democratic Party? And the challenge here for Republicans is to understand that, in fact, results have to happen. That's the sort of political discourse that I think the public is generally looking for. Here's the value proposition of the Democratic Party versus here's where Republicans are trying to go. What does that choice look like? As opposed to, yet again, going through a process of let's try to discredit whoever the other side has.
One more call. We have less than a minute. Dick in Algoma. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate
sure.
it. I have a two-part question, and you've kind of touched on both of them. The first one is school vouchers. I'm not totally against voucher schools. What I'm really concerned about is how the voucher schools take the the money from the local districts and the state, move it out of the district, and then if the voucher school fails, which a lot of them do, in my state over 50 have, they then send the kids back to public schools.
Dick, I'm going to have to hold you on that thought, and we have another email from a listener in Michigan who, as a public school teacher, literally every negative impact of my financial circumstance has been due to Republican policy, she says, in Michigan. This, of course, is a subject for another show because, unfortunately, we are out of time. David, thank you so much for being with us. Have a wonderful
pleasure.
Year, and we'll check in with you again. Thanks.
Okay. Great talking to you. Happy New Year.
And you too. Happy New Year. David Winston, our first All Things Political guest for 2017. We are rolling. And he is a longtime political analyst. He is president of the Winston Group, a strategic planning and survey research firm, has done a very excellent analysis of the 2016 election. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show and Scotty Myers for on-air production. Thanks for calling in.